From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! A 28-year-old woman who works for the top-secret electronic surveillance arm of the British Intelligence Service has been arrested. The arrest comes after a National Security Agency document was leaked to the London Observer, revealing agents had been ordered to bug the telephone and email communications of UN Security Council diplomats ahead of a vote on Iraq. We'll get an update from the reporter who broke the story. Then, less than 2 weeks after MSNBC fires Donahue, Phil Donahue, MSNBC launches a controversial new program by right-wing talk radio star Michael Savage.
MSNBC says it's offering a wide-ranging debate, but its actions show otherwise. They've just hired four new conservatives, Joe Scarborough, Michael Savage, Dick Armey, and Steve Malzberg, while firing Phil Donahue. A recent leaked document from NBC shows the cable station is cleansing itself of unabashed voices for peace.
But first, renowned authors Alice Walker, Maxine Hong Kingston, and Susan Griffin arrested with 20 other women outside the White House on International Women's Day.
I'm sitting in front of the White House because a group of us were trying to come in, and they were telling us that we could not come in, and we decided that we would come on anyway because it's actually our house. And, you know, the White House was built by some of my ancestors, my African-American ancestors. And so I wanted to see, you know, how it was holding up.
But first, police arrest the reporter covering the story. That was me. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. These are the headlines. The U.S. and Britain have been forced into more concessions in a desperate last-minute attempt to try to win enough swing votes on the U.N. Security Council to pass a war resolution on Iraq. The two countries agreed yesterday to define a short, clear checklist of disarmament demands. British diplomats in New York will also discuss suggestions from the so-called Swing Six Security Council members that the March 17th deadline will be extended. The New York Times is reporting in a closed Security Council session on Friday, Chilean envoy Gabriel Valdez asked in frustration how Iraq's compliance could be measured or how anyone could recognize a change of heart by Saddam Hussein without a specific checklist. He said, quote, "Is it like a religious conversion?" Meanwhile, Tony Blair is facing a rebellion in his own ranks. His International Development Secretary Claire Short yesterday threatened to resign if Blair takes Britain into war without UN backing. She called Blair's position on Iraq extraordinarily reckless. She said, "I will not uphold a breach of international law or this undermining of the UN, and I will resign from the government." Short's statement came after a cabinet member's parliamentary private secretary resigned and other aides threatened to follow suit. French Foreign Minister Dominique de Villepin is in Angola and heads to Guinea and Cameroon later today. They are swing voters in the Security Council. Anonymous U.S. officials are now telling newspapers that if the U.S. wins the Security Council vote, they will have won the moral victory, even if France, China, and Russia veto the resolution. The Bush administration has asked more than 60 nations to expel several hundred Iraqi diplomats. This according to the New York Times. The CIA claims the Iraqi envoys are spies and pose a threat to U.S. personnel overseas. U.S. officials are refusing to name the countries involved or offer any evidence. But on cue, Australia yesterday accused an Iraqi diplomat of spying and announced he has 4 days to leave the country. Buried within the article, the New York Times outlines U.S. motives. By seizing the Iraqis now, U.S. officials say the agents could choose to defect rather than return to Iraq just ahead of a U.S. invasion. One official said it's a superb moment to try to turn some of them and see what they know. Meanwhile, Iraq is continuing to destroy its Band al-Samud 2 missiles. It has now scrapped 46 of what it says are about 100 of the rockets. Over the weekend, Iraq issued a statement calling on the U.N. Security Council to lift 12 years of economic sanctions. The statement also called on the U.N. to strip Israel of its weapons of mass destruction and force it to abide by Security Council resolutions calling for the withdrawal of Israeli forces from Palestine. The chief UN weapons inspectors gave their latest report on Friday. The director of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Mohammed El-Baradei, said a key piece of evidence the U.S. has used was faked. After a careful investigation, UN and independent experts concluded documents purportedly showing Iraqi officials trying to buy uranium in Africa 2 years ago are not authentic. The Bush administration was using the documents to claim Iraq is developing a nuclear weapons program. The Washington Post reports sources familiar with the forgery investigation described the faked evidence as a series of letters between Iraqi agents and officials in the Central African nation of Niger. The documents had been given to the UN inspectors by Britain and reviewed extensively by U.S. intelligence, but the forgers made relatively crude errors that eventually gave them away, including names and titles that did not match up with the individuals who held office at the time. One U.S. official claimed, quote, "We fell for it." El-Baradei said there is no evidence that Iraq has resumed its nuclear program and no evidence Iraq has attempted to import essential items such as uranium or aluminum tubes. Overall, Chief UN Inspector Hans Blix reported the inspections are yielding results. France, Germany, China stood firm in their opposition to a U.S. invasion of Iraq. A 28-year-old woman working at the top-secret British government communications headquarters has been arrested on charges of contravening the Official Secrets Act. The GCHQ is the electronic surveillance arm of the British Intelligence Service. The arrest comes just a few days after The Observer published a top-secret U.S. National Security Agency document that revealed U.S. agents had been ordered to bug telephone and email communications of U.N. Security Council delegations from Angola, Cameroon, Chile, Bulgaria, and Guinea. We'll have more on that story in just a few minutes. There were massive anti-war rallies held around the globe this weekend. Tens of thousands braved torrential downpours in Britain, including 20,000 in Manchester in what some believe was the city's largest peace protest in 150 years. In Italy, tens of thousands marched from Pisa to nearby Camp Darby, a U.S. military base that is one of Europe's biggest munitions bases for U.S. and NATO forces. In Indonesia, up to 800,000 people gathered in the city of Surabaya. In the Lebanese city of Tripoli, 8,000 Lebanese and Palestinians protested. Over 40,000 marched in Japan. The protest came as the Japanese government announced its support for the U.S.-backed UN war resolution on Iraq. This despite the latest Japanese poll, which found 84% of respondents are against an attack on Iraq. The Episcopal Bishop of Washington and national leaders of the Methodist, Presbyterian, and Baptist churches have proposed a 6-point plan to, quote, defeat Saddam Hussein without war. In a significant shift for the religious anti-war movement, the church leaders say they fear a U.S. invasion is imminent and that the only way to stop it is to put forward concrete alternatives. The first point in the group's plan is establishing a U.N. tribunal to indict Saddam Hussein for crimes against humanity with the aim of removing the Iraqi president and his Ba'ath party from power. UN diplomats are debating whether Iraq is violating UN resolutions, but the Washington Times reports the U.S. may be in violation of UN accords. UN observers on the demilitarized Iraq-Kuwait border have discovered a series of breaches cut into an electrified fence that could represent part of the final preparations for a U.S.-led invasion. UN peacekeepers also report gates are being installed in apparent violation of UN accords established at the end of the Persian Gulf War in 91. And international observers reported seeing U.S. military personnel inside the demilitarized zone. Pentagon officials say U.S. Central Command Chief General Tommy Franks will be Supreme Commander of Iraq immediately after the war. But then Iraq will be divided into northern, southern, and central sectors. The southern sector is expected to be demographically dominated by Shiites and the northern sector by Kurds, but officials insist Iraq will remain one country. Retired general and head of the Pentagon's Office of Reconstruction and Humanitarian Affairs, Jay Garner, will oversee the effort. Two other retired U.S. generals will be in charge of the northern and southern sectors, and former U.S. ambassador to Yemen, Barbara Bodine, will rule the central sector that includes Baghdad. The International Committee of the Red Cross is leading protests by medical and human rights groups at U.S. plans to deploy tear gas and pepper spray to the Gulf. Senior ICRC officials say using the riot control agents would violate the 93 Chemical Weapons Convention. The protests were supported by the British Medical Association and the Geneva-based International Commission of Jurists. They say using the agents would undermine the prohibition on using chemical and biological weapons in war and would be exploited by other countries to justify their use of more dangerous weapons. A Halliburton subsidiary has won a Pentagon contract for consulting on rebuilding the oil fields in post-war Iraq. The contract was disclosed in the last paragraph of a Defense Department statement on preparations for Iraq's possible destruction of its oil fields in the event of a U.S. invasion. The contract went to Kellogg Brown & Root Services, which is owned by Halliburton. Vice President Dick Cheney was the chair of Halliburton until his election in 2000. The San Francisco Chronicle reports Halliburton's ties to Cheney arouse suspicions among those who believe that a primary motive for a U.S. war in Iraq is oil. The Toronto Star is reporting Kmart, Walgreens, and other U.S. retailers are stocking their shelves with Easter baskets in which the traditional front-and-center chocolate bunny is replaced with toy military figures armed with assault rifles and machine guns. One retailer said it was pulling the baskets after complaints. The Executive Committee of the European Trade Union Confederation has launched an appeal for work stoppages across Europe on March 14th at midday to support its request that all possible efforts should be made to disarm Iraq without going to war. It's understood that countries such as Britain, where political strikes are forbidden, could respond to the directive by opting for a minute of silence. And Time magazine is reporting that International Atomic Energy Agency inspectors have found Iran's nuclear weapons to be, quote, extremely advanced and much further along than previously revealed. The magazine reports that inspectors recently discovered that Iran was constructing a facility to enrich uranium in blatant violation of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. And the Washington Post reports that the U.S. now estimates that Iran could build nuclear weapons within 2 years. Iran has denied that its nuclear efforts are geared toward producing weapons. The Congressional Budget Office is estimating that sending troops and equipment to the Persian Gulf and back will alone cost nearly $25 billion. Meanwhile, the Labor Department reported on Friday over 300,000 jobs were lost in the month of February. Listening to Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And good day to all of our listeners and viewers around the country. And Amy, a big protest in D.C., and you as a reporter became part of the story. Can you tell us a little bit about what happened there?
Well, renowned writers Alice Walker and Maxine Hung Kingston and Susan Griffin and 20 other women were arrested in Washington, D.C. on Saturday. They were among thousands who marched on Washington for International Women's Day, protesting the Bush plans for war. The protest was organized by Code Pink, a play on the Bush administration's color-coded system of terror alerts. Similar rallies were held yesterday in 50 other cities from Anchorage to Honolulu. After a rally of thousands in Malcolm X Park, thousands then walked over to the White House. Code Pink thought they had a permit for the area in front of the White House. But when they got there, police mounted on horseback and otherwise lined up on the street prevented women from walking into Lafayette Park. But Alice Walker, Maxine Hung Kingston, magazine publisher Nina Utney, authors Terry Tempest Williams, musician Rachel Bagby, Fellowship of Reconciliation Reverend Patricia Ackerman, and others actually made it through the police line and they walked in front of the White House, in front of the fence, and they stood there and they sang peace, salam, shalom. And the police, though they had cleared the whole area, started to line up. They brought in horses. They took out their handcuffs. Moments before the women were arrested, this is what some of them had to say as I interviewed them for the various Pacifica stations around the country.
We started in Malcolm X Park. There were thousands of protesters, and then people marched to the White House. I'm right here next to Alice Walker, and Alice, maybe you could talk about how you came through here. Alice is sitting right in front of the White House.
Well, I'm sitting in front of the White House because a group of us were trying to come in, and they were telling us that we could not come in, and we decided that we would come on anyway because it's actually our house. And, you know, the White House was built by some of my ancestors, my African-American ancestors, and so I wanted to see, you know, how it was holding up. It's great to be here with all these women dressed in pink, all these children, and some men. It's a very great day to be out and demonstrating for peace.
And that's Alice Walker in front of the White House. We're also joined by Maxine Hong Kingston here on KPFT in Houston. You have a decision to make right now. Police are saying you will be arrested if you stay. Maxine Hong Kingston, her forthcoming book is called The Fifth Book of Peace. What are your thoughts about what you're going to do?
You know, I think it would be the very least I could do if I got arrested. Yeah, it would be just the very least, because there are people whose lives are at stake. There are children that we want to kill them. I mean, isn't that the least I could do, is to be here and do whatever it takes to stop that?
That was Maxine Hong Kingston standing in front of the White House. We're also joined by author Susan Griffin. Among her books, A Chorus of Stones. Can you talk about why you flew out with Alice Walker and Maxine Hong Kingston from California to Washington, D.C.?
There's no such thing as a smart bomb that avoids civilians. 3,000 missiles within 48 hours is going to kill a lot of civilians. We don't want that blood on our hands. We don't want those children. 50% of the population of Iraq is children. We don't want those children to die, and we don't want to start a vicious cycle of violence. We want to start a cycle of peace, and we want it to happen now.
At this point, the police were about to move in, and so I stepped back to cross the police line with the camera and the phone as I was interviewing the women, as did another person who was filming, Kristen Michael.
Yes, you can.
Excuse me.
Let's get the cameras on.
I told you to move. Ma'am, no.
Then let me go.
And they arrested the two of us as we were documented what was taking place, and then moved in on the 24 other women, Alice Walker, Maxine Hong Kingston, Susan Griffin, and the others. Juan, what was interesting is they had brought up the police wagons. And so reporters who are on the other side, and this is so often the tactic, cannot get any image, can't get a direct sight of what is going on. And again, when the state interacts with people, when they're about to arrest them, that is the time that reporters have to be there to watch what happens, to see if someone gets hurt, to see if someone is falsely charged, to see if the stories on both sides are conflicting or not. Those who were filming were pushed way back and could not get a real view. And I think that's clearly why they arrest people who try to get that picture.
And, of course, it's been a tendency of both law enforcement and the military in recent years, for a couple of decades now in the United States, to continue to try to push reporters back further and further from the scene of actual events so that They understand the power of the images and of the sound that people around the country can get from these kinds of events, and are seeking to try to control it more and more.
That's right. And the police then put us into the police wagons. They handcuffed us, putting plastic handcuffs, our hands behind our backs, went into the police wagon. We're taken to Anacostia Station. We were arrested, fingerprinted, pulled out our shoelaces, and put us into cells. We were in a cell about 5 by 8 with 7 women, open toilet, and only 2 people could sit at a time, and we were there for about 3 hours. They, after arresting us, they did release us, and when we walked out into the dark night, I did get a chance to ask Alice Walker, Maxine Hung Kingston, and Susan Griffin how they felt. Starts with Alice.
Alice, you've just come out of jail. How are you feeling?
I'm the happiest I've been ever. It was such a wonderful experience to know that I could be in jail and protest the war that is looming over the heads of children in Iraq.
And Susan?
Yeah, I'm pretty happy too. Yes, it's a very deep happiness. I'd call it joy.
Oh, yes. We have brought so much peace to the world already.
And that is 3 of the more than 24 women who were arrested. Before the event at Lafayette Park, before the protests that led to the arrests, all of these women protesting war was a major anti-war rally in Malcolm X Park. All sectors of society were represented. Among them was Gloria T. Johnson, who represents labor in the United States. This is Gloria T. Johnson.
My sisters and my brothers, you don't know how good you look. I didn't realize that pink was our color. But I got news for you, it is. And we are going to let the world know what pink stands for. It is magnificent. Love is in the house. Love is in the house. I have with me some sisters from the Coalition of Labor Union Women, which is a part of the AFL-CIO, and I want you to know that labor is in the house. Okay? Labor is really in the house. And the AFL-CIO has taken strong positions against this idiot that we have here in Washington. It's not time, and I don't have that time. I was just told to speed it up. But I think the gray hair might buy me a minute. So I'm going to buy me a minute. I'm so proud that across the country, groups like us have come together to try to convince those in power that what they are doing is wrong. We are loyal Americans. We are dedicated Americans. There's nothing wrong with us and what we are doing. And remember that. We might be criticized and attacked, but that isn't new to any of us, and it sure isn't new to me after 45 years in the American labor movement. So we talk about this nonviolent stuff that we ought to be doing. What I don't understand, and they got a sign up time, what I don't understand is how you can talk nonviolence when you talk about North Korea and you don't talk nonviolence in handling the situation in Iraq. Now, there's something wrong with that logic. And President Bush, do you hear us now? Do you hear us now? The thing that is troubling to us is that every time there is a war, and there have been enough of them, every time there is a war, military expenditures take away from the domestic problems. Wouldn't it make more sense to put people back to work? Wouldn't it make more sense to give the 41 million without health benefits health care? Wouldn't it make more sense to take this magnificent park and build it up to what it was years ago? Mr. Bush, you've got to get our message. I've got to leave. But I want to tell you one thing. We're on to you. We're on to you. And we know for a fact that you're feeding us a lot of crap. But the problem is, no matter how you cover doo-doo, it still stinks.
And that was Gloria Johnson, Coalition of Labor Union Women, speaking at the Code Pink rally on Saturday. Back in a minute.
Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper. Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper. While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around. Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds whisper. Poor people gonna rise up and get their share. Poor people gonna rise up and take what's theirs.
Talking about a revolution. Tracy Chapman here on Democracy Now! Following the International Women's Day protests around the world, also speaking on the stage at Malcolm X Park in Washington, D.C., was Nancy Lessen, co-founder of Military Families Speak Out.
Military families, thank you for all you're doing to bring our loved ones home. They are not George Bush's nameless, faceless military force. They are my stepson, Charlie's son, Joe. They are David and John and Josh and Justin and Alejandro and Nicole. We worry about them, and we worry about the beautiful children of Iraq and their parents. We may be on the brink of war, but we do not believe that this war is inevitable, even in the face of what we heard this week from Massachusetts Senator John Kerry's staff. We asked Senator Kerry through his staff, should Bush be the one who decides to go to war, and is now the time for our kids to start coming home in body bags? The response we got, Senator Kerry voted the way he voted in October, and he stands by that vote. And that vote unconstitutionally gave George Bush the power to take us to war, and that's why those of us on this stage have sued the president. George Bush is not a king. We have 1 week to stop this war. No more business as usual. Take some vacation days at work, in your community, in congressional offices. Find creative, collective, life and love-affirming ways to let the decision makers know this nation will not allow a new foreign policy of preemptive strikes, armed globalization, and premeditated murder. Do not let Congress off the hook. They need to step up to the plate. We need democracy in this country, and this is what democracy looks like. A young Marine reservist wrote us just before she deployed to the Gulf. I do not believe in this war with Iraq. I did not sign up to give my life for a personal grudge between two dictators. If I was not in the military, I would be chaining myself to the front gate of the White House protesting. Unfortunately, being in the military, I would be court-martialed for it. So thank you for delivering our message for us. And she signed it, the silenced few, the proud, the Marines. So for this young woman and for the world, no war in Iraq. Support our troops. Bring them home now, my sisters and brothers. We can do this. Thank you.
And that was Nancy Lessen, founder of Military Families Speak Out. Also, Hafsat Abiola was there. She came from Nigeria, Africa's most populous country, for the protests, another major oil country that the U.S. Has invested in heavily, unfortunately, under military dictators like Sunny Abacha. Her mother, Kudirat Abiola, was assassinated by the military. Her father, President-elect Masoud Abiola, died in prison under Sunny Abacha. This is Hafsat.
In Nigeria and across Africa, everybody wants to come to the United States. Everybody respects the United States. Everybody loves American people. When my father won the presidential election in 1993, and the military was trying to stop him from becoming the elected president of Nigeria, the first thing he did was to get on, after they threatened his life, he got on a plane and he came to the U.S. He met with Clinton. He went to France. He went all over Europe. And he said to these governments of these countries, of the biggest democracies in the world, he said, please help us in Nigeria. We want a democratic system. I've been elected president. Stop giving money to the military. Stop buying their oil. Stop giving money to the military. Stop selling them weapons. Instead of listening to him, they promised to help, and he went back to the country. The soldiers in my country put him in a tiny cell for 4 years. And the American government continued to sell weapons to the Nigerian soldiers. They continued to buy oil for about $12 billion every year. The military, with all that money, with all those weapons, waged a war on the people of Nigeria. You are now learning about terrorism. Nigerians have known about terrorism for 30 years when the military controlled our government. My mother, who was organizing, started working with labor women in Nigeria, market women, labor union leaders, to stop the military and to stop the continued oppression of the Nigerian people. After some time, the military gunned her down in 1996 because they were tired of having a woman standing up to their oppression. They didn't count on her having a daughter. When my mother was killed, she left behind 5 children below the ages of 20. The youngest was 9. I was 21 years old. I had not even graduated from college. We had no money. And I started to take care of my younger siblings and started to build the movement for democracy in Nigeria in the international community. I came and I worked with Amnesty International in the US. I worked with Amy Goodman. We worked with so many people across America. So many thousands of people across America helped us. We went to Canada, we went to Europe, and finally, the military saw that there was going to need to end the military system. They invited the U.S. State Department to meet with my father to negotiate with him. The U.S. State Department officials offered my father some tea. He started coughing. He died. They came out of the meeting and they said he has died of natural causes, and they left the country. When now we hear that America wants to go to Iraq to help bring democracy to Iraq, we wonder, who are they fooling? Who are they talking to? Who can believe this nonsense? The women in Nigeria continue to fight the military's dominance in Nigeria, because even though we have a democracy, the new democracy is not a democracy. It's the kind of democracy America will bring to Iraq. Our government is buying hundreds of millions of dollars of weapons from the United States instead of giving us food to eat, instead of funding schools, instead of taking care of health care. This is the kind of democracy that they mean to bring to Iraq, and it's not the kind of democracy that can work for any people anywhere in the world. I'm going to close up now by saying to you that I have hope. I have hope because I'm seeing something that I've never seen in my life. I never saw it when we were fighting for democracy in Nigeria. The UN did nothing then. But look at the UN today. The UN is acting to stop the military system, the military's movement into Iraq. And why are they doing this? Because you are standing here. Because you are here telling them that you will not stand for war. I'm going to go. Thank you. Keep on standing. Keep on fighting.
Hafsat Abiola, you are listening to Democracy Now!, thousands, tens of thousands of people protesting all over the world this weekend. And there have been other developments around the world as well. a 28-year-old woman working at the top-secret British government communications headquarters, has been arrested on charges of contravening the Officials Secret Act. The GCHQ is the electronic surveillance arm of the British Intelligence Service.
The arrest comes just a few days after The Observer published a top-secret National Security Agency document. The memo revealed U.S. agents had been ordered to bug the telephone and email communications of the U.N. Security Council delegations from Angola, Cameroon, Chile, Bulgaria, and Guinea. The surveillance operation was designed to help the U.S. win votes for the war resolution on Iraq. The Observer reports the NSA document was leaked to the paper by British security sources who objected to being asked to aid the U.S. surveillance operation. Meanwhile, the United Nations has launched a top-level investigation into the U.S.'s spying operation.
We're joined by Wayne Madsen, who's senior fellow at the Electronic Privacy Information Center and former National Security Agency intelligence officer. But first, we're going to turn to Martin Bright, who is one of the reporters who broke the story with the Observer of London, co-author of the piece U.S. Dirty Tricks to Win Vote on Iraq War. Martin Bright, welcome from London. Can you tell us these latest developments?
Yeah, it was quite shocking. We heard about these developments very late in the week. In fact, on Saturday, as we were going to press, that a young woman had been arrested at GCHQ, the government surveillance, the government electronic surveillance headquarters, as a result of our story. And obviously, this is a deep shock to us, and we are extremely concerned for this individual. And I only hope that if she does end up being charged, then there will be an international campaign to support her.
And can you, once again, for listeners who haven't heard our show over the last week, because this is a story that has gotten very little attention, especially in the networks in this country where most people get their information. But what this top secret U.S. National Security Agency document said?
Yes, we received the document which was sent out from the National Security Agency at the end of January. And it said very clearly in a certain amount of intelligence jargon, but clearly enough for any ordinary reader to see, that the NSA had authorized a bugging operation on United Nations delegates in order to get intelligence about the way they were voting or the way they were intending to vote, the negotiations they were having, in order to help the American the Americans get what they called an edge. This was something which I'm sure your guest, Mr. Madsen, would explain is not unusual. But what is unusual is that they were caught. And what is highly unusual is they were caught as a result of a leak from an otherwise friendly intelligence agency, in other words, the British, and this is extremely unusual.
And let me ask: in England, under the Official Secrets Act, not only is it a crime to disseminate top secret information, it's also a crime to receive it. Does that mean that conceivably some of you and some of the other members of the reporters at your paper might be facing action by the government?
Well, I reserve the right not to incriminate myself on air, but potentially the charge can be leveled at a third party who receives documents. Yes, in Britain, there's absolutely no question about that. And the Observer, myself personally, we have found ourselves in this position before with a case involving a British intelligence officer known as David Shaler. It's a pretty grim process. Yes, the laws in Britain are very, very draconian, and there is no defense of public interest. There is no public interest defense. You cannot go on the stand and say, I did this for the good of my country, I did this because the British people had a right to know. It is completely cut and dried. If you breach the Official Secrets Act, that is that. There is no real defense.
Wayne Madsen, you're a former National Security Agency intelligence officer. Can you talk more about this memo and about the actual lack of coverage of it in the United States, this idea that the U.S. is now engaged in spying on, bugging the U.N. Security Council members that include Angola, Cameroon, Chile, Bulgaria, Guinea, and Pakistan?
Yes. Well, when the story first broke, shortly thereafter, there were reports primarily from Matt Drudge, who I don't consider to be an authentic journalist, suggesting that the memo was fraudulent, was fake. But knowing the type of memo it was actually an email, because NSA, like every other major operation, uses the same type of free-form email. People were saying, well, some of the wording was incorrect and wasn't the right format. I said, well, wait a minute. Obviously, this type of email would be exactly what you would see on the NSA systems. And so now that we know about the employee being arrested, I think we can put Mr. Drudge's speculation to rest. On the content, asking allied agencies to help with espionage, electronic surveillance of missions to the UN. Of course, this is what NSA does all the time, and I'm not suggesting that it's also legal. It's within the NSA charter. But what's unusual, as Martin said, is that the memo leaked because there's now a huge policy difference within not only British intelligence, but within American intelligence about where Mr. Bush and Mr. Blair are heading. And I would also add it was that the surveillance was not only directed against the members of the Security Council, but also it states against other missions which may have an impact on the U.S. vote. And obviously we know that Canada was shopping around its own resolution compromise. We know that the Holy See, Vatican City, the Pope has been instrumental in another compromise, and they have a mission to the UN. So I would expect that the espionage was much more widespread than against those swinging six members of the Security Council.
And how does this compare, for instance, the laws in Britain to those in the United States, for instance, in the Daniel Ellsberg Pentagon Papers case, which obviously was more extensive in terms of what he revealed, but how do the laws in England versus the United States differ in terms of protecting journalists about revealing a situation like this?
Well, right now we're pretty well protected, but, you know, with the passage of the Homeland Security Act, one of the things that they've tried to get through here for a number of years, going back to Clinton, and President Clinton vetoed this, was to create a British-style Official Secrets Act here in the United States so journalists could not only be prosecuted, but also their offices and homes could be broken into if they thought that they were receiving leaks from people inside the government. So right now we're okay, but look, there's another USA Patriot Act getting ready to be dropped by Mr. Ashcroft, and I would expect that we may see that Official Secrets Act embedded in there.
Martin Bright, on Thursday night, the President of the United States, George Bush, held what some have described as a news conference. Others have described as a speech that he gave interrupted by sentences of various journalists. But he opened by saying that scientists are required by Iraqi intelligence to wear concealed recording devices during interviews, and hotels where the interviews take place are bugged by the regime. These are not the actions of a regime that is disarming. These are the actions of a regime engaged in a willful charade. These are the actions of a regime that systematically and deliberately is defying the world. Your comment.
Well, my comment is that I am a journalist who reports as objectively as I can. And if it were proven to me that were going on, then I would be obliged to report it in the same way that I've been obliged to report this American Dirty Tricks campaign. I'm not going to be going into the business of suggesting that in some way either process is justifiable, and nor am I going to be suggesting that the Baghdad regime is in some way equivalent to the Bush regime, or indeed the other way around. Clearly, Saddam's regime is one of the most appalling and oppressive regimes in the world. What I think has been raised by the story that we've run about about the particular espionage that's been going on in the UN is that people within the intelligence community believe that a line has to be drawn, that we must not be moving towards Middle Eastern-style, Saddam-style intelligence operations, that there should be rules. There's a kind of rather romantic idea of intelligence operatives in the States and Britain, the kind of James Bond-style license to kill operatives. But actually, in reality, there are rules and there are laws that govern our intelligence services, and that's why we do not live in countries that are like Iraq. So I think that we have to be careful here not to suggest that the two countries are equivalent, but nevertheless we have to be very careful that we do not slip in the West towards oppressive styles of intelligence operation.
And if one thing that this whole situation is revealing to us as the administration continues here in the United States to move toward war is that even those who would move rapidly toward war and utilize all of the war machine, that war machine is populated by human beings, many of whom make decisions based on their conscience and on their beliefs and not just in following orders. And so in this case, apparently, there were some within the British intelligence community as career intelligence officers who felt that their conscience wouldn't let them this kind of communication pass by without getting out. So it's a lesson to all of these political leaders who think that people just follow orders no matter whether they are right or not.
I think that's right, and I think that one thing that we do have to start looking into as journalists now is the question as to whether we really think that a 28-year-old woman within the GCHQ building in Cheltenham in Britain would have had the seniority to have done this alone. I don't know, but I think it's up to us to investigate now whether this was in some way an institutional leak, or indeed whether it was a wider group of disgruntled individuals rather than simply this young woman. I think it's very unlikely that it was just one rather young individual.
Disgruntled with the way the Bush and Blair axis are using intelligence. I mean, there have been so many intelligence scandals from the most recent. In our first hour, we reported on Niger and the fake document that the U.S. is citing comes from the British that said that Saddam Hussein was getting nuclear components from Niger, turned out to be a forgery. Then you had your British intelligence document that Colin Powell cited in his case for war at the United Nations that turned out to be a plagiarized graduate student's report from California that was written some 12 years ago. You think intelligence is some people within intelligence are getting angry at the use of so-called intelligence, even the so-called link between Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein that the intelligence agencies themselves have said there is none?
Well, we know this to be the case because of off-the-record briefings that we've had. We know that there is a huge level of discomfort within the intelligence services as to the way that, in particular, the Al-Qaeda Iraq link has been made. I mean, Mr. Madison will be able to explain that in more detail than I can, but certainly in Britain there is deep unhappiness at the spinning and the political use that intelligence information has been put to. That's absolutely right.
And here in the United States, we also had the situation with the CIA initially putting out an assessment that the war, that unleashing war in Iraq would create more terrorism in the United States. So we have a situation where obviously there are levels of intelligence when it comes to the intelligence community.
Well, we want to thank you both very much for being with us. Martin Bright, journalist with The Observer of London. We will certainly follow this case and also what happens with you as journalists who have released this information, a top secret document. And certainly certainly the most important way to protect people who report on this is for others to report on it. In this country, people should call the networks and ask them about this National Security Agency document that has been leaked that says the U.S. is spying on the U.N. Security Council diplomats as they prepare to vote on a second resolution. And thanks to Wayne Madsen, Senior Fellow at Electronic Privacy Information Center, knows about the NSA because he is a former National Security Agency intelligence officer. We'll be back in a minute. We'll continue to talk about the media. Every move you make here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez, and now, due to popular demand, Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report has expanded to 2 hours. This broadcast is available to stations starting at 8 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. We're broadcasting an hour earlier to, in an attempt to fulfill your requests. In our first hour today, we reported on the Chief UN Weapons Inspector's report to the UN Security Council, including El Baradei's announcement that some evidence the U.S. has repeatedly used has been faked. We also looked at how some progressive Democrats may introduce legislation calling for the impeachment of George Bush. If you'd like to help in our grassroots efforts to let people know about the program and its new extended 2 hours every day, you can get information at democracynow.org or call your station and ask them to run the full 2 hours. We're talking about the media, and it's so important to have a national forum to get out independent voices. On Saturday, cable station MSNBC went ahead with the launch of a controversial new program by arch-conservative talk radio host Michael Savage. This came despite protests from the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation and other advocacy groups. Savage heads the Paul Revere Society, an organization which advocates closing borders, deporting illegal immigrants, mandating health tests for immigrants, eliminating entitlement programs, and making tax cuts permanent. Savage's debut comes less than 2 weeks after MSNBC fired Phil Donahue at a time when his show was the network's top-rated program.
A leaked internal NBC study indicates Donahue was fired because of his anti-war views. Media analyst Rick Ellis obtained a copy of the study and outlined portions on his website, allyourtv.com. The study found Donahue presented, quote, a difficult public face for NBC in a time of war. He seems to delight in presenting guests who are anti-war, anti-Bush, and skeptical of the administration's motives, end of quote. The report goes on to outline a possible nightmare scenario where the show might becomes, quote, a home for the liberal anti-war agenda at the same time that our competitors are waving the flag at every opportunity. Donahue has not spoken publicly about his dismissal, but issued a statement that indicated MSNBC was trying to silence anti-war voices in favor of new conservative hosts. He wrote, quote, the hiring of Mike Savage, Dick Armey, and Joe Scarborough suggest a strategy to outfox Fox.
We're joined right now by Steve Rendell, senior analyst at Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, FAIR. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Amy.
So the Mike Savage show began this weekend, and Phil Donahue is no longer on MSNBC.
Right. I think Phil Donahue's quote that MSNBC is trying to outfox Fox is being maybe too kind to MSNBC. In hiring Michael Savage, they've gone, I think, perhaps beyond a point, to a point where Fox may hesitate to go. I don't want to give Fox too much credit here, but Michael Savage is a gutter level bigot. He referred to the Million Mom March a couple of years ago, where a lot of mothers got together to ask for more strict gun registration restrictions. He referred to that as the Million Dyke March. And he referred to the pictures that the moms were carrying. There were pictures of kids who had been killed in inner city violence, and they were mostly Black and Latino kids. And he said, those aren't kids. Those are ghetto slime, he referred to them. At the same time, he regularly calls non-white countries turd world nations. He does this even in his book, where you'd think he might have been a little more careful. He regularly refers to homosexuality as perversion. He says Latinos breed like rabbits. I wanted to maybe in a minute play a bit of tape. In his debut show, it's an hour long, 5 o'clock on Saturday, he took probably 20 calls, all of them from sycophants, all of them kissing up to him. One caller managed to get through who was critical and was immediately cut off, thus putting the lie to MSNBC's whole notion that what it's trying to do in hiring Savage, but not just Savage, also former right-wing Congressman Joe Scarborough, Dick Armey, who you're all familiar with, former congressman, and Steve Malzberg, the right-wing shouter from WABC radio. But Savage is a gutter-level bigot, and when he's on the air, apparently the policy is nobody can criticize him. So it's quite interesting.
Well, the Minority Telecommunications Network sent a letter to NBC recently, and they don't do this normally, and they said that you've basically hired a white supremacist now to have space on your station, on your network, and demanding that he be removed.
Yes, and you know, there's it's broader than this too. I'm right now working on something where I have Michael Savage referring to Jerry Springer, who's Jewish, as the hook-nosed Jerry Springer, referring to Madeleine Albright as the brisket maker, using all of these things that, if they weren't coming from the mouth of a guy who was born Jewish, he's born Michael Wiener in the Bronx, they would be deemed absolutely outright anti-Semitism.
Well, let's hear some Savage remarks.
Here is the one caller that got through that was dissenting.
Unbelievable cover-up. Stephen in New York, welcome to the Savage Nation topic, please. Stephen, you're on the Savage Nation topic, please.
Hi, Michael. I've been listening to you for years, and it's I'm really glad I'm on your first show here.
All right. How do I look, Steve? You like my makeup?
You look terrific. The jacket looks like vinyl, but I'm sure it's leather.
Nah, don't you dare say that. And inside it, I have real fur.
First of all, I really can't wait till you take on these guys from Fairness and Accuracy and Reporting.
No, don't even mention them. I don't refer to any of the people who are slandering me. They are irrelevant.
Okay, I want to ask you, my girlfriend is from Mexico, one of the places you call a third world nation. Who?
Thanks for the call. I appreciate it very much. Have a nice day. Okay.
That was Mike Savage's first show.
Well, you can see the way that any sort of dissent was cut off. Every other call to a call was in favor of Savage and was congratulating him on his new show.
Right now, Phil Donahue off MSNBC, this memo coming out saying that at a time, what Juan quoted, the nightmare scenario for MSNBC would be a, quote, home for liberal anti-war agenda. At the same time, our competitors are waving the flag at every opportunity. And so Donahue is dumped, the highest rated on MSNBC. He's got.
Yeah, the highest rated on MSNBC, but I think
seconds.
It could have got even higher rating. If you look at the show from the very beginning, it was fettered. The first show had Ritter on talking about disarmament, and he was outshouted. Recent shows with Phyllis Bennis and Medea Benjamin on, they were both outshouted and outnumbered by conservatives. As Ralph Nader points out in a recent column, this was imposed from top management. And so the idea that this was a liberal show that finally got a chance is really false. It's really not true. MSNBC, if it is ever going to offer a liberal show, it hasn't done it so far. It hasn't offered a show with unabashed leftish viewpoints
Well, Steve Rendell, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Affair, that does it for the program. You can get a copy by calling 1-800-881-2359, 1-800-881-2359. Our website, democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Noguera. Special thanks to Elizabeth Press, Gail Murphy, and Kirsten Michael. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
Six foot six above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it.